I don't want to run into you head on, Charles. Thank you very much, Charles. That's two nights in a row we've been getting together. I don't know if we keep at this, you'll sound like the broken record. But it is an honor to privilege to be speaking here in Sydney, and as it was last night in Melbourne, to a group of people who I know hold very important positions in the world of commerce in your country, a country that we in the United States have grown to love greatly ever since we fought together in World War II, and our former president, Lyndon Johnson, flew out of Townsville, and all of those in the American military who were in the Pacific, they certainly developed a wonderful warm feeling for the Australians. So I think that we are really brothers and very, very close friends, and it's certainly an honor to come to Australia. I've been here, I think this is the 40th visit I've made in the last 20 years, and I must say that when Hugh invited me here and was so kind to arrange all these fine meetings, I just got another thrill that I'll have a chance to come to your great country. Now, what we're talking about, of course, in the United States, and what I was asked to talk tonight about by Hugh and Charles and others, was the question of where we're going with these huge government expenditures. Now, we were very fortunate in the United States to have elected a president who is not a politician. In other words, he's a man who has held many titles, including representing General Electric, which is a big company in the United States, as you know, for many years on the PR front. He was a movie actor, he was a union leader, and he was finally governor of California, but only because his friend persuaded him to run for governor. So he's not a politician at all, despite the fact that he's probably the best natural communicator, and which is a very important part of politics in the world. I've never seen anybody who communicates better than he does. And he communicates well because he has a fantastic sense of humor, and he's honest. He comes through as really being honest. I don't know how many of you saw his State of the Union message this year. I don't know if any of it was broadcast, but if you didn't see it, you ought to see it, because it was the greatest performance that you can possibly imagine. It was his birthday, and he had everybody, their eyes were wet, talking about great Americans. He introduced a Vietnamese girl who was in a West Point uniform and had her stand up, and she was a beautiful specimen of somebody who came from Vietnam 15, 18 years ago, got into West Point, one of the highest marks in the academy, and she stood up, he said, only in America. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house, because this man is really a great communicator. Now, he's worried to death and has been talking for years about the great weight of the central government on the backs of the productive people in the United States. And he's been dedicated for years in trying to get the federal government to become much more efficient and much less wasteful. It's been the policy he pursued as governor of California. He invited 100 businessmen in to look at the state government, and they came up with 2,000 ideas, and he took 1,600 of them and saved $221 million and left California with a major surplus, which was immediately dispersed by the next guy who came along. His name was, you probably remember, Brown, Governor Brown. He was going around with that Linda Ronstadt, the singer, you know, and he lived in a single pad. He wouldn't even live in the governor's mansion. He had an apartment around the corner. You know, there's too many people looking and seeing what you're doing if you're in the governor's mansion. So you have to at least be married. But anyway, this fellow Reagan is terrific. I never met him. He telephoned me one day when I was with two Australians. One was Rupert Murdoch. You may have heard of him. I think he owns one of the airlines, doesn't he? And Then there was Maxwell Newton. He's a very good columnist, you know. He tells you where you have to think about before you make your investments. They happened to be having lunch with me in my office, and I have our company is in 43 countries, and so you have to have secretaries that speak foreign languages, and I have an English secretary, and almost everybody in New York who wants to put on airs has an English secretary, because there's something very stuffy about English secretaries. You people came from England at some point, so you know how stuffy they can be. And she came barging into the dining room and said, "The president wants you on the phone." Well, this had never happened to me in my life before, to have them phone me out of the blue. So I said, "Hey, Cynthia, we'll see you later. We're busy. Keep going and don't bother us." So she, no, he's on the phone. So sure enough, I pick it up and there he was. And he said, we had a little vote in my office and the Oval Office today. And he says, "You got elected and I want to do this job on waste and inefficiency in Washington." He said, "Just like we did in California." And he says, "We can't give you any money, but we'll give you all the information. So will you do it?" So, of course, I said, I had to say yes. So I said, "Yes, Mr. President." Well, about 3 weeks later, he wanted to sort of see what I looked like. I'd seen him on the tube. You call it the telly here, but I'd seen him on the tube, of course. I knew what he looked like, but he didn't know what I looked like. So I got out to Los Angeles to see him, and his main concern was the defense. Now, you people spend about, as I remember it, 2.1% of your GDP on defense. We spend 6.8% on our defense. And when Eisenhower was president, we spent 10.4% of GDP. Kennedy spent 9.4%. And now we're down to 6.8%. And the president is concerned about our defense posture. He is concerned about the fact that Russia has a 4-to-1 throw weight over the United States in land-based missiles. He's concerned about the fact that Russia spends 12 to 15% of its gross national product on defense, while we're spending 6.8. And he's very concerned about the weapon systems. He said that he had developed and decided as commander-in-chief, and he said somebody has to be commander-in-chief here, and he said, "I've decided that we have to have certain weapon systems." He said there are 14 of them altogether. And he said, I know there's tremendous waste in the Defense Department, tremendous. But he says, I want you to go in there like a hungry bloodhound and find it all. But he says, don't mess around with these 14 weapon systems. So I told him, I didn't even take Popular Mechanics as a magazine in America. In high school, I said, I don't know anything about weapon systems. So you must remember that it was 18 years ago that the United States, in 1966, the United States built its last B-52 bomber. And it was also 18 years ago, in 1966, that we deployed the last land-based ICBM, that's intercontinental ballistic missile. Meanwhile, Russia has developed, produced, and deployed 10 new strategic weapon systems, including 3 new strategic bomber types, and also 3 new ICBM systems. And 75% of all Russia's strategic weapons are less than 5 years old. That's something you don't hear much about. And 75% of our strategic weapons are more than 15 years old. So that's the kind of a problem that the president faces. And in the last 10 years, 74 through 83, Russia spent 1.4 times what we spent on strategic weapons, and on strategic force spending, twice what we spent. And the throw weight of the land-based missiles, as I say, is 4 times what we have. Sea-launched ballistic missiles, they have 980 to our 616. And finally, in heavy bombers, they have 400 to 325. So the president is very definitely concerned about the defense situation. And I am too. And so therefore, what we've got to do is cut out the waste, but not allow a ruthless group of people like the Russians, who are carpet bombing Afghanistan and who have done so many terrible things over their history, to have a tremendous advantage on a weaponry basis over the United States. So after we finished discussing that, he said to me, you know, when I was governor of California, he said, there were more federal employees all around the state than there were state employees. And he said, I couldn't imagine what they were all doing. So he said, it was none of my business anyway. He said, but now I'm president, I got to know what all these people are doing out in California. So you find out for me, please, how many there are, where they work, and what they're doing out here, because I don't understand it. So I said, of course I will, and I rushed back to Washington. I had an office in the executive office building in the White House complex, one floor below the OMB, and I was told that they were going to give me all the information I needed. That was a cruel joke, but because they didn't know anything themselves, and I found that out the first day on the job. I run upstairs, and I said, hey, the president wants to know how many employees there are in California. He said, we don't know how many employees there are in California. So I said, well, he wants it, get it. They said, well, we don't have it, son. Now, look, baby, there are $62 billion of payroll in the civil servants. There are 2.75 million of them, and that $62 billion doesn't include their pension cost, which is another 82% of payroll, because they're indexed for life and they can retire. They're actually vested in 3 years, and they can retire at 55, or they can retire at any time when they are so-called disabled, and you can be disabled in the government in the slightest problem, and you are disabled. So I'm going to announce that you got a $62 billion payroll, and it would be with a $50 billion pension reserve added to that a year, $112 billion, and 200.75 million people. You don't know where they're working or what they're doing. So they said, oh, you wouldn't. I said, yeah, I'm going to do exactly that. Well, it says, we'll see what we can find out. So they finally got a computer run showing all employees by state, but they didn't show where they were working or what they were doing. And they said, now, really, this is the most that we can give you. So I said, well, I'll have to go back to the White House. Now, I didn't report to the president. I reported to Mr. Meese, who's now the attorney general, but he was a domestic aide to the president. I told Ed Meese, I said, I can't get the number of employees in California, where they're located, what they're doing. So I says, we got to find a better way to answer the president's questions. He says, now, Peter, he's a very nice man. He says, you're going to be so busy with all these studies. He says, we have that somewhere here. And he said, we'll get that, and I'll let you have it as soon as I get it. Well, I haven't talked to Washington in the last few hours, but I was still waiting for that. And Ed Meese has moved on to attorney general now, so his substitute is still looking, too. And there's no way to tell, by the way. We do know that they occupy 2.6 billion square feet of office space, because the General Services Administration has the control of all the office space. And by the way, that's all the office space in the 10 largest cities in the United States times four. And they occupy that, and they spend 2 to 3 times the square foot cost of occupying and managing that space as the insurance company people that we had on our commission, because they had all their figures on what it costs to run their building. And it's 2 to 3 times the square foot cost, and we don't know who's in all that space or what they're doing. Now, the government is the biggest conglomerate, or our government, biggest conglomerate in the world. They have 744 million acres of land that they own. That's all the land east of the Mississippi, plus Texas. You have to add Texas. That's a big state. And they own all that land, and they have 161 million acres of timberland, and they let people come in and cut firewood off that to the extent of $250 million a year of firewood. They have about 180 million acres of pasture land, and they let people rent that land, and they recover 38 cents on the dollar of the out-of-pocket cost. Now, you know, You know, in Australia, you need about 100 acres up in the Northern Territory for a cow, but you can get some good pasture land down outside of Melbourne. You can run one cow to an acre, particularly if it's a Santa Catutus, and you can do pretty well. So anybody that can't make at least, if you put a cow and a calf on an acre, and the calf will be born, you know, and will grow from about 200 pounds to 400 pounds. And you can sell that calf when it's 500 pounds into a feedlot, and that's how you fatten it out. And you certainly can recover the annual cost of an acre. If cows in the United States are selling veal at 60 cents or something, you put on 300 pounds, 180 bucks, that does not cost that much to run an acre of pasture land. So the government basically doesn't know how to run anything, and they don't know what they're doing in our country. They have 332 incompatible accounting systems. That actually, you can't find any facts, and I have 319 different payroll systems. It costs five times as much for the government to write a check as it does in the private sector. Now, on these accounting systems, for instance, we got down there, we looked at a student loan program. We have three different student loan programs in the United States, and we said, hey, you don't need three programs. Why not merge them, one program, and do it in one shop, not all over the Washington, all over the lot. So we says, what's the overhead in each of these? No way. You can't find any overhead. There's no overhead element ever identified in any of the figures in Washington. You get the suspicion it's all overhead. And that's why they don't know how to identify overhead. When we were looking at these student loans, by the way, we began to find out that some of these students hadn't paid their student loans. These people go to college and they get out and get jobs and are supposed to repay their loan. We found a pitcher on the New York Mets. He went to Yale. His name is Darling. He makes $330,000 a year. Hadn't paid on his student loan. We found orthopedic surgeons, dentists, doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists. We even found a guy in Honolulu who has seven real estate development projects, and he hadn't paid his student loan. But the worst thing was we found 44,000 government employees, federal government employees, who owed $68 million on their student loans. So we went to the OMB, says, look at these guys. They're working for you, and the years and years they haven't paid their student loan. So why don't you garnish their salary? You've seen Mortimer Snerd, haven't you? Well, I don't know why we're not sure. So now we went to the president with that one, and now they're garnishing the salaries. But this is just an example. They make 36 attempts in the private sector to collect a bad debt. The government makes a couple of attempts, and they just ignore it. And actually, the government is owed $850 billion. They guaranteed or have lent $850 billion. When we went down to Washington, there was $1.25 trillion debt. Now it's $1.6 trillion. And by the way, I don't know how many of you people in Australia have looked at the trillions, because in our company, we only deal in millions and profits, and in sales, we're up around, you know, 7 billion or something. So I had never worked with trillions. But when you get down there, you've been there a month or two, you know, it starts to roll off your tongue. Pretty good. As a matter of fact, when you're with Dave Stockman in the OMB, you'll find that they don't even say trillion, they say trill. Hey, you say to Dave, what's that, 0.72 trill, Dave? No, you say it's near a 0.8 trill, Peter. So, you know, you're rolling around, and it's almost like the sniffing coke or something. You get a real thrill. The blood is running faster the more the trillions you're dealing with. Now, but I got down there and I asked some guy in Washington. I says, how much is a trillion anyway? Yeah, million. He says, 1,000 billion. You know that. Yeah, I know, but what does it amount to? Well, we all got finite minds, not infinite minds. We're not infinite, any of us. We hope to get into the infinite in the next world. But now we're finite. We're all going to end to dust and all this stuff, you know. So we put it in Volkswagens, little Beetles, and we put it in six-packs to see how high the pile went. But it didn't work. I mean, it was still infinite. So I finally put it on time. And the moment that Christ was born, someone started counting seconds. Like that. Right now, he'd be at 62.5 billion seconds. And that's 6.25% of a trillion. It takes 31,700 years, folks, to count to a trillion seconds.
And that's 317 centuries. And we're still in the 20th century. So there's your 6% coming right back at you, see? And so when you get down to Washington, and we started working on the outlays. Now, outlays, that means spending, outlays. For the first 3 months, we worked on the outlays. And one of these days, I said to ourselves, where the hell do you get these outlays? Well, it says that comes from obligations. Didn't you go to school? The Congress passes obligations, and then they trickle down through the system in the form of outlays. So where's the breakdown of all the obligations? Because that's where this stuff starts, see? Well, it's got a 15,000-page book over here of appendices, and that's where the obligations are. Nobody ever looked at it or studied it, but it's sitting over there. So we said we better get a record of the obligations and what's going to roll through. So it took us 10 man years to study this big book of obligations, and we found that as a pattern, the obligations are 1.4 times the outlays. Now, we're going to spend this year $975 billion, and therefore the outlays are about 1.35 trillion. The obligations are 1.35 trillion. They're always 40% more than the outlays, and they're always coming through the rye, as they say, absolutely coming down the pike. There's no way to stop them. It's like turning the Leviathan around or a big ship in a little narrow river, because this thing is just rolling. So it's very, very difficult thing to get under control. So we decided we'd look at the cash flow of the government to see how much moves through this system. And it amounts to exactly $2 trillion a year, the total cash flow that moves. Now, if you divide the year into 250 business days, that's $8 billion a day, or $1 billion an eight-hour day. So when we found that out, geez, we got really sweating, nervous. We had to hurry here. It's $1 billion an hour. And we know there's so much waste. Come on, guys, let's go. But you can only get volunteers to work just so hard, you know. You can only stimulate them for so long. You'd call a guy up and say, now, we got to do so-and-so next week. Will you be down on Tuesday? Yeah, we'll be down at 10 o'clock Tuesday morning. We're all flying in from all over the country, volunteers doing this job. And, of course, they wouldn't get in until Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and you had a date at 10 o'clock Tuesday. But you can't go to those people. They, what the hell? I mean, you didn't get here yesterday, you lousy SOB. No. They're volunteers. Say, gee, it's great you got here today, and thanks a lot for helping us with this. You try working with volunteers sometime for 2 years. You'll find that it takes an awful lot out of your system, I'll tell you. But anyway, we were 2,000 of us. We did muddle through. We did find 2,478 ways to save our government over 3 years, $424.4 billion. Now, what we did is we said, now, these guys aren't going to listen to us. The president would. We know that because he was in touch with us all the time. We were in the White House at least once a week feeding the stuff into the White House. Although that wasn't entirely kosher, because under our laws in the United States, once a commission has been founded, they have to go public, even if they have a meeting. In fact, I got down to Washington. I was trying to staff this thing up. And the White House counsel told me, he says, you know, anytime you have a meeting, you have to announce it in the public register, in the federal register, and the public can attend the meeting. And he was announcing that to this group of us that were in the White House. And I says, listen, his name is Fred Fielding. I says, listen, Fred, just stop talking like that, because we're not going to have any meeting. If that's what we have to do, we won't meet. Because we're not going to let the public come in and listen to this crap when we're trying to get ourselves straightened out. So we never held a meeting. We just talked on the phone, or we got together in little groups and in halls or something, but we never had a meeting. Now, we found out when we got down there were 17,500 computers. You know, with a 332 accounting system, you don't know how you program these damn computers, because you got all these different systems. But anyway, in looking at the computers, we found that 12,000 of them were obsolete by 6.5 years. And some of them, they're so bad, they're so old, that we have to have $600 million a year spent on a special repair force in the government to repair the 17,500 computers, because the manufacturers don't remember anymore how to repair these old obsolete computers. So we have the $600 million expense. So when I ran into that, I got a hold of Frank Carey. He's the CEO of IBM, you know, the big blue, you know, the big blue. And I says, Frank, how about getting down here and helping us with this computer problem? Great. He says, I'll be glad to do it, Peter. And so I go over to Fred Fielding. He's a counsel in the White House. No way. He says, you're bringing Carey down here to look at the computers? I said, yeah. He says, he cannot be done. Why not? He said, he knows too much. It's a conflict of interest. So I said, well, that's ridiculous. Are you saying that nobody can come down here on the 17,500 computers or knows anything about computers, has ever been in the computer business? That's right. Yeah, conflicts of interest. So we finally got Bill Agee and Mary Cunningham and some other kids around that have never been in the computer field. And even then, they found $14.3 billion of savings over 3 years in the computer field. Now, actually, in fact, when a bureaucrat in Washington wants to order a computer, it takes them 5 years because it's got to work its way through congressional committees and there's all kinds of problems. Now, the software end of the computer business out in, you know, Silicon Valley and in Japan, you know, right across the Pacific from Silicon Valley and on Route 128 in Boston, these guys are flying. They're coming up with new ideas. People are obsoleting other people in 6 months. And so, therefore, if it takes 5 years to get a new system and they're obsoleting a lot of this software stuff in 2 years, then you're falling behind an additional 3 years every 5 years, you see, because that's the way the system works. We figure out that the whole computer systems in the government are going to be 10 years obsolete in another 5 years, not 6.7. So we've got to get somebody to do something about that. And we came up with a whole series of recommendations of reorganizing how the government works. For instance, we don't have a chief financial officer in the government. We have a cash flow, as I told you, of $2 trillion. Now, if you just sped that cash flow up in terms of collections in the government, and if you slow down the payments, they've been paying states too early, so that the states take the money and invest it in interest-bearing accounts because the government is paying them too early. They don't collect soon enough. We found $62 billion that could be accumulated in extra cash by just running the cash flow on a zero-balance basis. For instance, when the Department of Justice, when they hit these big hauls of cocaine money and all that, they stick it in the safe deposit vault. They don't put it in interest-bearing accounts. And that's even under Jimmy Carter when interest rates were 21%. And they still, they put it in safe deposit vaults. So they don't give a damn about anything. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Carter, you know, when he left down there, as I mentioned, there was $850 billion that the government was owed. And at that time, the government owed $1.2 trillion. Now it's 1/6. During the 2 years we were there, the government went up from 1/2 to 1/6. So, you know, we didn't help much. $400 billion of additional debt. But when he got down there, it was 1/2. And the government was owed $850 billion. So he says, hell, 1/2 and take away $850. You know, that's only $350 billion net debt. It's not that bad. Maybe it's okay. Maybe our kids will come through here. So he says, when is this $850 due? Well, it never been aged. They didn't know when it was due, when it might would it ever be paid, who owed it, or anything else. Just this clod of $850 billion. That's more, 3.5 times the total income taxes of all the American people. So we aged it, and it was $39 billion in default. And that still is not under control because of the computers. For instance, when we found all these government employees that owed on their student loans, we told the White House, and they got in touch with different cabinet offices, and we have a defense secretary by the name of Cap Weinberger. Oh, he says, that's very bad. He says, I'll write to the Secretary of Education and find out how many employees the Defense Department owe on their student loans. So he writes, and 6 weeks later, he gets it back all in statements, you know. But that's crazy. That stuff ought to all be on computers. You can't be. We're operating in the dark ages here where people are writing memos. So how many people in the Defense Department haven't paid their student loan? All that stuff ought to be on computers, as should the total amount of social programs that we have. Now, in the United States, we had a president, you remember, by the name of President Kennedy, and it was in the 60s, and everybody loved him, and his wife was very beautiful, Jackie Onassis, you know, you've seen her picture, I'm sure, and so they were known as Camelot. That's what they call romantic, beautiful days, Camelot. And now we have Mr. Reagan and Mrs. Reagan, and they call it Scrooge, and because he's cutting back on social programs. So we wanted to get the bottom of that, and we try to find out what the social programs were under Kennedy. Well, they were $38 billion, or 5.6% of gross national product. Now under Scrooge Reagan, they're $462 billion and 13.5% of GNP. So that shows you what the liberal press can do with just naming things like Camelot and Scrooge. Nobody knows the numbers. People are absolutely economic illiterates in the United States. Nobody has any figures. They all get the 7 o'clock news on the boob tube or the telly. And if President Reagan is trying to curb some program like the food stamps, they'll put on some big fat lady with a bunch of adopted kids or something in there and says, they can't take my food stamps away from me. And that's the news for the night. Meanwhile, there's $1 billion of fraud in the goddamn program. It started with $40 million. Under Kennedy. Great idea. No starving in the United States. $40 million program. The next time we turned around, it was $13 billion. And they're down in Puerto Rico. It's a small island with 3 million people. They were getting $1 billion down there. $400 per person in food stamps. So this thing just gets wildly out of control. Just like AIDS for families with dependent children. As soon as a girl has a baby at age 14 and they put her on the payroll, then she finds she can double the amount she's getting by having another child, illicitly, of course, out of wedlock, and you have two more children, the income is pretty good. And therefore, there's a tremendous amount of immorality because we're subsidizing all this immorality in the United States. And these programs, when we went to the OMB on that one, we said, always ask the OMB, how many social programs have they got? We asked, 110, 130. One of our fellows went out in the bookstore, he found a book called How to Get Yours in Fat City, that's Washington. And there was 300 programs, and took up the OMB, hey, there's 300 programs. Well, maybe they are, we don't know how many they are. You better find out. Well, we studied it for 6 months, there are 963 social programs. Imagine, 963 different ways of subsidizing indolence in our country and persuading people they don't have to work and that you owe them a living. Those programs are called entitlement programs. Who the hell is entitled to them? What do they call the people who get the dough? Clients. They had some clients in last night talking about how much they were receiving. This is the way this thing is going. Now, if you don't show great sympathy with that whole system, they immediately say you lack compassion. Compassion, that's an important word. You must never lack compassion. And I'm telling you that I don't like all those programs, and I've got compassion for our children. I've got compassion for our grandchildren. I got compassion for anybody under the age of 30 years of age. Because in 15 years, our total debt is going to be $13 trillion. The annual interest is going to be $1.5 trillion. Our total deficit in the year 2000 will be $1.966 trillion. $466 billion regular deficit plus $1.5 trillion in interest. I have arguments with politicians every day in Washington about cutting this or that out of the budget. We found 2,478 ways to save $424.4 billion. But just talk one buck with Tip O'Neill. He's the speaker. Hey, Tip, not that buck out. It's waste. Nah, I'm leaving it in. Well, Tip, where are you going to get it? We're spending 25% more than we're taking in. Borrow it. Tell the Treasury to borrow. Where does he get the interest? Borrow it. Where does he get the interest on the interest? Borrow it. Next year, it's $1.05, a little inflation. Yeah, borrow it. Where did he get last year's interest? Borrow it, etc. Well, you take out a little calculator, and you give yourself a compound calculation of 10% interest and 5% inflation over 17 years. That's the last year we did our study. And every buck is $71. So our $140 billion a year, multiply it by 71. That's what it is, cumulative. Over that period, it's $9.8 trillion. So we either are going to go right down the drain, and we made a study showing if they did what we suggested, and it wouldn't cut anything, it wouldn't cut any of the fat out, any of the muscle out of the defense, it wouldn't hurt any people in the social program except for the fraud. It would stop the Social Security system from paying out $14.3 billion in checks to dead people. And that's been done, and when the families get the checks, they're all in mourning, but they suddenly forget, and they open the envelopes, cash the check. So that's the way it goes in the government. It's the same thing in the Defense Department. You read about 2 cent screws, we're paying $91, $346 for a $7 hammer, etc., etc. About 3 weeks ago, we ran into the situation of a $675 toilet seat covers that were being bought from Lockheed. We rushed up the Defense Department and said, what the hell is this, $675 for a toilet seat cover? They said, well, Secretary Weinberger hasn't taken a position on them yet. Now, so that's the kind of stuff we're running into. I can tell you that there's so much trouble getting the Defense Department. They have 4,000 military bases. They only need 320 considered essential. They got Fort Monroe in Virginia right below Washington. It's so old they have a moat around it. And when they wanted to close that, a congressman from Virginia stood up and he said, wait a minute, I'm going to get an environmental impact statement on this closing. That'll be another 2 years, folks. See, now remember that now. Remember that the Congress of the United States is the fault. It's not the president. Those of you who are businessmen, ask yourself what powers you have to run your business. One, you have to organize your business. Two, you have to set the pay scales and the bonuses. Three, you control the capital expenditure. The president can do none of those. 43 governors of the United States have item veto power. Knock it out. This, yes, no, yes, no, 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 etc. All the Christmas trees. President can't do that. We're going to get him that power. He's trying to get that power. I was up before a congressional committee last year arguing for the line item veto, and one of these guys gets up and he says to me, Mr. Grace, you're arguing for autocracy, national autocracy. I said, that's a hell of a lot better than national bankruptcy. And that's where we're heading, folks, if something isn't done about this. Now, I don't know anything about Australia, except I know you collect 4% more of GDP than we do, 8 percentage points more of GDP than we do on taxes. Your deficit is very serious, and but you don't have as big a debt. Our debt is 44% of our gross domestic product, GDP. Now, New Zealand has 70%, and they're adding 7 percentage points each year. How any of this is ever going to be handled by Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, New Zealand, United States, anybody, nobody can tell. We've all got together and get together and get some common sense to save our children and our grandchildren. We formed a group in Washington called Citizens Against Waste. We've got 6 million signatures. We're getting 100,000 a week. And we're going to the American public and saying, write us and give our names, give us your names on computers, and the first congressman that won't do this or that is going to get postcards from 30,000 people, and he's going to sit up and take notice. A year ago, they made anybody who had a company car had to put every night, if his wife had a headache and he went to the drugstore to get her some aspirin, he had to put it down 2 miles to the drugstore. They call that contemporaneous automobile record. Hell, that got to be so unpopular in the first 3 months, the United States Senate voted last week 96-1 to eliminate that. So when the people speak, when you get them excited, when you get them uptight, they will listen. And that's what we're going to do in the United States. And if there's anything that we can tell your prime minister tomorrow or anything else, if they want to know what we found out, what our methodologies were in making our studies, or any suggestions, if they want them, we'll be glad to make them. And thank you very much for your attention.
First question, what was the reaction of the White House, Congress, and the public to your recommendations?
Those are really three questions. The White House, enthusiastic, at least insofar as the president was concerned. The Congress, 20% favorable, 40% more or less waiting to see which way the wind blew, and 40% massively antagonistic. The public, it depends what part of the United States you were in. If you were in the Northeastern Corridor, which is controlled by the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, they paid no attention to us. As soon as we got west of Pennsylvania, they love us. Yeah.
What role should businessmen play in public debate? What is the reaction of your board and shareholders to your public appearances?
Oh, we've had nothing but friendly letters from our stockholders, except for about 100 people who bought one share, and they probably worked for the government and wrote snotty letters, and we don't pay any attention to them at all. As far as the board is concerned, I had the honor of being CEO of our company for 40 years, and so I have had the honor and privilege of appointing the board, and...
How did you go about setting up and staffing and organizing your inquiry?
Well, that was difficult because of the fact that they wouldn't give us any money. So the government, the president says, no money but all the info. So we had to go out and ask people who had staff and money, because if you just asked some nice guy, he didn't have any staff, it wouldn't do us any good. So what we had to do was go to the heads of all the big companies in America and ask them if they would come down and become serve on the executive committee. Now, the White House assumed in the beginning there would be 15 on the executive committee, but they had no idea at all how big this job was. We had 47 different task forces studying the government, and each task force needed about 30 people on it. So, therefore, we had to get all those people, and the only way you could get them is to get company heads who would ask their auditing firms or their suppliers, their lawyers, etc., to put staff in Washington. It cost $76 million. So what we did is we formed 47 task forces. We picked 22 task forces for each department and agency. We had one for the Office of Secretary of Defense, including the Joint Chief of Staff. We had one for Army, Navy, and the Air Force. That was four in the defense. Then we had the Treasury, State, etc. And as we ran through all the agencies, we had 22 task forces. Then we picked all of the functions of the government, whether it becomes freighting, whether it became personal travel, which is $5 billion a year, and they don't get any discounts at all. We could save at least $750 million a year, or a total of about $2 billion on the travel expense alone just by getting discounts. And the freight bills, the same. We went into freighting. We went into user charges, personnel management, computers, accounting systems, all of the staff services. So we had 22 plus 25 task forces, and we put the best people we could who didn't have a conflict of interest onto those task forces. We got 2,000 people down there. They made space available in all of the agencies and the departments, and we just fanned out all over Washington for 2 years, prepared 1.5 million pages of work papers, converted it into 21,000 pages of printed report, and gave it to the president on January 16, 2 years after we started.
How much is the failure of Australia to support the MX missile damaged our relations with America? Do you see any similarity with the New Zealand position?
Well, it's very difficult to damage the friendship of the United States for Australia, particularly after the tremendously close relationship that we had over the years. I think it was well understood in the United States after the position taken by New Zealand that Prime Minister Hawke had to do something to ally the so-called left-wing labor group here, and in doing the MX missile, he threw them a bone. He also said that I'll leave this office before I will take the same position as the New Zealanders took, and I think, therefore, Australia came out ahead on the game because there was Australia once again coming up regardless of the MX thing. I think that was a bone he had to throw them, but I think that it didn't damage the relationship at all, and I think it's stronger than ever.
This ends side one of your tape. Please fast forward and turn over for side two. Yes, you know,
Yeah, the man looks open to the boss.